Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 2nd, 2005. Today's session, Tikkun Olam, Social Justice in Jewish History and Literature, presented in the Fireside Room by Carla Swamala. Disc number SUK 2005-02. Let's listen in.
3,000 years worth up on that board. To kind of get a sense of it, all right? And so, the kinds of things that I'm doing this week, a lot of it has to do a lot, we've got to bring in a lot of history, because it's not necessarily history that everybody's familiar with. People know about the Holocaust and other features within Jewish history, but a lot of these other things are a little harder to peg, actually. So what we're talking about today is Tikkun Olam, to mend, heal, or perfect the world. That's sort of the theme of this week. Which entails, what is the role of a particular faith community, in this case Judaism, what is the role of that community in the larger world? All right. So yesterday we took a look at Genesis 12, where God tells Abraham to be a blessing after promising him some things. So we examine kind of that, what does that mean to be a blessing? And today we're going to kind of unpack that in Jewish history. How have they understood that? In that idea of being a blessing with the objective of mending, healing, or perfecting the world, especially in their relationship to the outside world. All right. The way I put this chart up on the board, just to kind of give you a quick overview as I refer to these as we go along, Proto-Judaism, there are a lot of different things that you can call that category, and you can certainly split it up into many more categories, but Proto-Judaism is the Judaism, or the religious tradition that actually preceded the Judaism that we think of today. It is what the Hebrews, then the Israelites, practiced, right? And we call it proto because it's really dominated, first of all, by sacrificial temple culture, tribal culture, monarchy, things like that. Whereas there's a huge break between Proto-Judaism and the rest of history, in that those things don't characterize Judaism at all. Also, some key events that emerged in that Proto-Jewish period include exile and Torah. Right? And so that were the biblical texts, especially the Hebrew Bible, emerged in that period. Right? With rabbinic Judaism, and there's a break, I specifically have Proto-Judaism ending in 1st century CE, or Common Era. Some people use AD to mark that, but you've got a huge event. Does anybody know what happened between that 1st century and 2nd century in Judaism in general? There's one key, one major thing. A lot of things, but we always think in New Testament terms, but what's the big event that happened?
Are you talking about Jamia, Council of Jamia?
Nope, right before that. What caused that to happen?
Oh.
Destruction of the temple.
Destruction of the temple.
Destruction of the temple.
Right.
It's one of the things, whether in Bible or whether in Judaism, I tell my students, you need to memorize 70 CE so that if I wake you up at 4 in the morning and shake you and say, the temple was destroyed, and their response should be, first or second? And I say second, and they say 70. But it's a huge break in Judaism, huge. And it has a huge impact on Christianity as well. Because all those sorts of things that characterized Judaism before that were no longer in play. And so you have kind of a gap in there when Judaism had to reconfigure itself to, in fact, figure out, can we continue to be the people of God without a temple? Our centerpiece, our heart. And they were, in fact, able to do so. They were able to reconfigure who they were. And instead of having the religious tradition wrapped around the temple and the priestly class and Jerusalem, all of those things were off limits pretty much after that temple was destroyed. The Judaism of that new era was centered around rabbis and synagogues. That was a very portable Judaism. You can say, I call it rabbinic Judaism, but I think just a word that's just as applicable is portable Judaism. You could have Judaism in a suitcase, And they did. That's why that first key word is important, diaspora. Diaspora refers technically to any Jew who does not live in the Holy Land. All right. Now, I've heard Lutherans who live in Alabama call themselves diaspora Lutherans, but I don't know that that... you know, and they can do that facetiously, but I think, you know, and there is something to be said about that, especially for those of us who live in the Midwest and think that we're at the center of things. But really, for in Judaism, Jews for the last 2,000 years, the majority of Jews in the world have lived as diaspora Jews. There has always been a Jewish presence in what we call today Israel, but at very, very low numbers, especially after the destruction of the temple and in those early centuries of our common era. All right. Now, a couple of key features emerged in this new Judaism, this rabbinic Judaism that emerged. A couple of them are there. Oral Torah became a centerpiece. The written Torah was part of the biblical text. That is what we see in the Old Testament or Hebrew Bible. What cynical scholars, maybe like myself, or we call ourselves realistic, say is this was a rabbinic invention. This whole idea of oral Torah. Rabbis at that point started discussing the issue, and they said that at Sinai, God in fact told Moses some other things that Moses didn't write down. We got
Gnosticism?
No, not even Gnosticism. It's stuff that, because they passed it on. Gnosticism has to do with secret knowledge. Right. This was passed on, but orally. Because they believed that oral tradition had a certain fluidity that written tradition just didn't have. Sometimes today we're kind of suspicious of oral tradition, at least in the West, because we think, well, you can't, you know, how can you be precise about things? But on the flip side, there is something very fluid about oral tradition and more stable than written tradition because it can adapt to language and to context far more readily than a written text can. It doesn't, it stays static in some ways. And so with the temple nearly being destroyed and with Judaism kind of out, hanging off the edge of a cliff there for a while, they thought, going back to Jamnia and some of these sorts of this council, we don't know very much about whether they held councils or when, that sort of thing, but it looks as if there were some meetings in small towns outside of Jerusalem in the countryside where rabbis got together and said, okay, how are we going to keep this thing going? How are we going to keep Judaism alive without the temple? Is it possible? And if so, how? So they talked about this and they said, first of all, we've got to write that oral Torah down. All right, these are probably things that have been passed on through parts of proto-Judaism, oral tradition. They said, we need to write it down. All right. And when they did that, the first compilation is a text called the Mishnah. All right, it's legal. It has not a lot to do with the biblical text, but it expands on the legal materials that we see in the Old Testament, kind of, you know, providing cases, and if this and this happens, then, you know, this is a further explanation. So it's a legal text. It doesn't sound, you know, particularly sacred, but it is in the Jewish tradition. You also have a further development of a material called Midrash. Midrash is not a book, it is a body of literature that can continue to expand. It is commentary on scripture, not necessarily legal material. Right? As time went on, there emerged the need for more discussion of the legal material. You know that legal material breeds legal material because you can always find a question, well, what about if this happens? The Talmud is, in fact, a further commentary on Mishnah. All right? So this is a very complicated set of texts that we're dealing with and very, very dense. But they're fascinating once you get into them. Most non-Jews and most, I guess you could even say Jews today, are probably more familiar with Midrash because it's more readable. All right? Most people, and Jews included, have not been schooled in Talmud since the age, in Mishnah, since the age of three, and can manipulate the complicated rationale that emerges there. But still, it's a huge part of the culture. All right, more traditional Jews still adhere to Talmud and take it very seriously. All right, So those are a couple of things. And then a couple of other things emerged. The Talmud was closed, it looks as if it was primarily pulled together over a couple centuries, done at about 600 CE. All right. You have other movements emerging in that period of 2nd century through 1600. Mysticism. You have a very active mystical Jewish community emerging, particularly in the Middle Ages and in Spain. And so if you've heard the term Kabbalah, that's a part of the centerpiece of the Jewish mystical movement, all right? Not mainstream. Mysticism was never mainstream in Judaism, just like mysticism in Christianity, mysticism in Islam. They're almost always fringe movements by their very nature, all right? But still have significant influence on mainstream. Other philosophical schools emerge in the Middle Ages and right prior to the Middle Ages among Jews. Philosophers, a key one among them named Maimonides emerges, if you've heard that name. He wrote some tremendous works. One of them is called Guide to the Perplexed, which in fact is a very perplexing work and nearly impossible to work your way through. So I'm not sure who it was written for, but the man was clearly a genius. And he was influential in the Jewish community. He codified all that stuff before that, Mishnah, Midrash, Talmud, all that stuff that had sort of been coming out in a very non-systematic way, and systematized it. Now, another great medieval thinker caught on to Maimonides. Aquinas said, this is a good system. And if you know anything about Aquinas, systems were his thing, all right? If it could be organized or ordered or classified, when it comes to theology, thinking about God, the Christian life, Aquinas was there, just like Maimonides was, all right? So those are some key sorts of things. Also during this rabbinic period, the 2nd century to 1600, with most Jews living in the diaspora, which means what we call today the Middle East, North Africa, all over Europe were the primary places where Jews were living. All right. In that, depending on the country they were in, there were periodic times of persecution. All right. Jews consistently fared better under Islamic rule than Christian rule. They almost, and down the line, Muslims treated Jews better than Christians ever did. You know, when you take it, if you look at it statistically. So, but still, they were never in a majority and they never had access to avenues of power like their Islamic and Christian counterparts did, all right? Some of the persecution became extreme, especially in parts of Europe. As early as the Middle Ages, there was a lot of hatred against the Jews. They were called the killers of Jesus. Other parts of the world, the pogroms that started in Russia, Central Europe, Eastern Europe, those sorts of things continued on periodically, right? With the 1600s, you have kind of a break in history, all right?
Go back to my dish, Tim, I'm sorry.
All right. You have kind of a break in history. You have the Enlightenment showing up on the screen of the world, especially in Europe. And that's going to change life for many Jews. All right. With the Enlightenment, especially in places like Germany and France, but particularly Germany, which had a large population of Jews, Jews for the first time in their this history from the 2nd century were allowed to do a couple of things. They were allowed to become citizens. They were allowed to own land. They were allowed to matriculate in universities. They were allowed to join guilds of artisans. All right. They were allowed to move out of their ghettos or isolated neighborhoods and buy homes in other neighborhoods and really integrate into society. They could actually vote if there were elections to be held. All right. This is kind of a remarkable thing in the history of Judaism. So you have Jews at a huge rate integrating into society and participating in society like you've never heard before, or like you've never seen before. One key Jew that kind of represents modern Judaism and the Enlightenment is a philosopher named Spinoza. He was actually excommunicated by his Jewish community, but he represented that kind of crossing over into mainstream Enlightenment thinking and attracting a much wider audience than Jews previously had. All right, a couple of other things emerge. Judaisms emerge. You have a couple different groups emerging during this modern period. The groups that we know of today, you've got Orthodox Jews, you've got Hasidic Jews, you've got modern Orthodox Jews, you've got conservative Jews, and you have Reform Jews. There are also Reconstructionist Jews and Renewal Jews, but those are more this century, a little bit more recent. But those groups, the five that I mentioned first, really emerged in the 18th and 19th centuries. All right? So you have different approaches to being Jewish, partly because you could. Before that, it wasn't easy to do. All right? So this, a lot of other things also then happened in the modern period. Movements like Zionism, tragedies like the Holocaust and World War II. And finally, the founding of the State of Israel in 1948, which was the first time in over 2,000 years that Jews had their own autonomous land and leadership. All right. So that's kind of a quick and dirty on history. And the reason I did that is because a lot of things I'm going to be talking about in terms of the Jewish understanding of themselves to mend, heal, or perfect the world was very much conditioned by these different historical periods and their historical circumstances. All right. So when you take a look at going to Rabbinic Judaism for nearly, 1800, almost 2,000 years, starting with that Rabbinic Jewish period, Jews had very limited ability to impact their wider culture.
Excuse me, by Rabbinic Judaism, you mean rabbi?
Yeah, okay. A Judaism that has rabbis really at the center, as opposed to temple.
What was the change of the role of the rabbi before the formation of Rabbinic Judaism, before the destruction of the temple?
Rabbis were just considered simply teachers or community leaders. They didn't have a significant role, and not necessarily every community would have had them. They were simply teachers, but they moved into more of what we would today call a clergy position or a leadership role in Rabbinic Judaism.
So the priests basically disappeared.
Pretty much disappeared because they were all surrounding the temple. The temple was destroyed and thousands of people were killed in Jerusalem. So you had a lot of Judaism wiped out with the destruction of the temple. So you really don't have a surviving priestly class that has a significant amount of impact. The rabbis traced themselves to the Pharisees. All right, the Pharisees were the most widespread of the different Jewish groups in that first century. Groups like the Sadducees that contained a lot of priests, things like that, were so closely associated with the temple and living in Jerusalem that when the Romans came in and destroyed Jerusalem, they died. So you have the Pharisees more widespread throughout the land and a little bit more organized, at least having a wider base.
I was going to ask a question about
the
priesthood.
Okay, yep, kind of dead. You had some other Jewish groups during that time. You just mentioned the Essenes. They were the Dead Sea Scrolls people down by the Dead Sea who put together a lot of writing materials over about a 350-year time period. They were wiped out with the destruction of the Second Temple. The Romans, it looks as if the Romans destroyed that Dead Sea community shortly after 70. CE. So you have that kind of movement wiped out, and they were all very clustered in one area, so you didn't really have a lot of influence from them. Like I said, groups like the Sadducees were almost entirely wiped out because they were all located in Jerusalem. Another Jewish group called the Zealots was nearly entirely wiped out because they were fighting the Romans, didn't fare so well. All right. Other groups that sometimes people call the Sicarii are sometimes similar to those Zealots. Again, wiped out. The other Jewish group that you had in the time were the Jesus followers. We call them Christians today, but they weren't called Christians yet. They survived because by that point, by 70, because of the work of Paul, they were spread around the Mediterranean basin through Turkey into Greece and throughout the land of Palestine, so they had a wider base. So you basically have two survivors from Proto-Judaism, the Jesus followers and the Pharisees. That makes sense? A little too much history in some of these things, but in some ways these are kind of some ground rules that we kind of need to figure out the scheme of things. So these rabbis, when they thought about the text from Genesis 12, the command to Abraham to be a blessing, and in the family of Abraham, all the families of the earth will be blessed. They read that and understood that in slightly different ways. For the most part, they were very isolated, and they applied that sort of command to their own communities. They figured, we take care of our own, God is responsible for the rest, partly because we don't have access to the world. The world wasn't too happy to be spending a lot of time with Jews. So they figured their best vantage point was to take care of their own, survive, and let God take care of the larger world. All right, because for the most part, they were isolated, they were poor, they weren't in a lot of the key areas of power, right? So that's kind of one of the aspects. And in fact, many rabbis were very suspicious of the non-Gentile or the non-Jewish world. You know, it's kind of like we stick to ourselves, they stick to themselves, we'll be okay. But not all rabbis and Jews thought that. The one great thing about those bodies of literature, Mishnah, Midrash, and Talmud, is that many, many opinions were written down, even if they were minority opinions, and they have come to us today, and they were read and discussed, even if they weren't the majority view. And you have rabbis in that time period talking about those sorts of things, and they started thinking, and you have some rabbis saying, well, you know, I don't know, that might be a little easy. That, or you know, maybe not a correct reading of that, those Genesis passages and to be in the Isaiah passage of being a light to the nations. We think God does want us to have something to do with that larger community. We can at least pray for them. All right, well, that's a good start. So you have Rabbi Hanina saying to the Jewish community, pray for the welfare of the government, for were it not for the fear of it, people would swallow each other alive. So bottom line, pray for the government so that we don't end up in mass chaos and anarchy. You know, good, very practical, all right? So that was kind of a bottom line, pray for them at least. Others went a little further, and actually there are others like Rabbi Hanina, who in their own communities suggested more direct action in their own communities and perhaps beyond. Because they reflected on Moses at the Red Sea, sometimes called the Reed Sea, where, you know, ready to part it, he's praying and praying and praying, and God says, Moses, there's a time for prayer and that's over. It's time for action. Get these people to move. So, you know, they said, you know, they're trying to always balance that aspect. You know, they said, yeah, prayer is good too, but prayer needs to accompany action. All right. So they started thinking about this a little bit more. But I love that phrasing. This is the way it sounds in Midrash. The Holy One, blessed be He, chastised Moses for praying at great length rather than instructing the Jews to travel. So Moses, get a move on. Amen. And so some rabbis even went further than that to talk about what kind of action should happen. And they looked again at Genesis 3, where when Adam and Eve left the garden, they had started out naked, God clothed Adam and Eve. All right, we hear that God made the clothing for them. The rabbi said, you know, if God clothed the naked and we are in the image of God, then perhaps we should clothe the naked as well. If that's a quality of God that we share, maybe we have a responsibility. And any naked, the naked or poor in our community, the naked outside of our community. So they started to think a little bit about that. They also looked at some scriptural passages, others as well, in terms of their role in the community. They looked at Genesis 33:18, where it talks about how Jacob, the great patriarch, comes into the city or village of Shechem. And the biblical text says, Jacob was gracious to the city. And the rabbis, the way they evaluated each and every word as having content, not being repetitive, not being redundant, and as communicating something very important, had to think a little bit about gracious. Gracious is not just being nice. It's not a behavioral sort of thing. It has material content to it. All right. So then when Jacob was gracious to the city of Shechem, the rabbis thought, now how might Jacob have been gracious? How might that have worked? We find some different possibilities. Rav speculates that Jacob instituted coinage for the people of Shechem. You know, kind of set up a good currency system. Why not, you know? Samuel, Rabbi Samuel, suggests that Jacob instituted markets for them. Got a good, you know, economic system going with markets. That would have been, you know, to their material well-being. And Rabbi Jonathan comes at it from another angle. He says that the patriarch Jacob instituted public baths for the people of Shechem, which is also a good thing. So you kind of like, how was he gracious? But you notice each of those rabbis, that's just a sampling, has a very material sort of concrete thing in mind. All right, from body to economic well-being, those are things that they speculated on. And they thought, because Shechem clearly was part of the non-Jewish community and their patriarch was doing something gracious for that community. So they, it wasn't something that they could ignore. Right? One, you know, so they always had to return to these sorts of things. Regardless, though, of some of these more minority opinions, as I had mentioned at the outset, these rabbinic Jewish communities were more isolated and not to interact. There wasn't opportunity for interaction with the larger non-Jewish world. The larger non-Jewish world in which they lived, there are a few notable exceptions. But for the most part, they were isolated and were not allowed to participate in larger society.
Mm-hmm. A lot of the commands to care for the poor, the hungry, you know, the strangers, would they have just assumed that those had to do only with the internal concerns?
Yes.
Because they were never in control of a larger.
And they didn't encounter a lot of the other poor, the hungry, that sort of thing, if they were in ghettos or aid neighborhoods, or they weren't really even allowed to interact. So yes, they took those commands to care for the orphan, care for the widow, care for the sick, care for the stranger, as being those among them. So travelers, Jewish travelers, that sort of thing, providing food for poor families on the Sabbath, taking in children, making sure that widows had a shelter, had a roof over their heads. Yes. Within their Jewish communities, welfare was very well organized for the most part and very, very carefully done. In fact, there's a practice that on the Sabbath, before the Sabbath start, people would go through the synagogue and drop off money if they had extra and take it if they needed it so that no one knew who was putting it in and who was taking it out. And so it was kind of one of those things so that there was no embarrassment about it, so that your family would be able to have a Sabbath, would be able to eat as God intended. All right. So those are sorts of things. And there are lots of discussions about the welfare systems that they put together in their own communities, which are pretty remarkable when you think about it.
You know, it almost sounds like we have the internal makings of ghettoization going on here, not external segregation, but like they're pulling into themselves.
Well, they were in part, and it was pretty much enforced, partly because throughout Europe during the Middle Ages and up until modern times, they were largely an agricultural society. Well, when you have a people who's not permitted to own land or participate in the guilds or live where they choose to live, they were forced into a ghetto-like situation. Because of jobs, education, professions were just limited. So, you know, there is some sort of thing. So it wasn't necessarily so much by choice. If Jews had had the opportunity to own land and pursue agricultural lifestyles and live in other places, it looks almost certain that they would have done so. Because when given the opportunity, Jews always integrated to some extent.
Most of us have no idea. I mean, the average person goes from the New Testament to, you know, the creation of the state of Israel, our knowledge of the history of the Jews is zero.
Well, that's because Jews and Christians had so little interaction, really, for 1800,
right.
1900
exactly.
years. It's amazing that we're sisters, but don't know each other.
Yeah.
You know, because we really are sisters, but we just, and part of the problem of that is that breeds a lot of ignorance on both sides and suspicion, you know, and trying to figure that out. But yeah, it's kind of interesting. So yeah, and they were in ghettos. That's where the word ghetto actually comes from these Jewish neighborhoods where the local mayors and people in the area determined that the Jews would live. And usually it wasn't in the village proper, but always a little outside.
And so we're talking Central Europe here. Because
Central, Eastern, all the way through Russia.
Shtetls, I mean, a little...
That's the same word for ghetto. It's the Yiddish word.
Yeah, shtetl is, of course, a slang word for a little city.
A little city, and that's where Jews were required to live. So you had your shtetl papers, but you didn't have citizenship papers. You also couldn't travel then. If you're not a citizen, you couldn't get travel papers. So, yeah, there are a lot of issues there.
Do you have any idea of when this happens? Because... It's sort of a, suddenly you get to the Middle Ages and you got the ghetto, but do you have any idea how that
It was emerging during that time period between 200 and probably 900, where you start seeing 1,000, you start seeing more fully developed Jewish communities in and throughout Europe, the Middle East, Northern Africa. But they were extending because they weren't really permitted to stay in the Roman Empire. What happens in the 4th century, a key thing happens for that impacts Jews and Christians that kind of has changed the course of their relations forever. The Emperor Constantine makes Christianity a privileged religion in the Roman Empire. It goes from all of a sudden minority status to top of the line. It's not the official religion yet, but by 392 it is the official religion of the Roman Empire. As that happens, Judaism becomes the truly persecuted religion, and there's not a lot of tolerance toward it. All right, so you have that time period up until the 4th century where Jews and Christians were really very much on their own, and both persecuted. But after that, when Christians take over, they don't treat their fellow, their sister Jews very well at all. And in fact, as bad or worse than the Romans had done. So that's really, and from that 4th century onward, you see the Jews moving outside the Middle East and throughout Europe into small communities. And you have actually the one place where you have a thriving Jewish community that produced a lot of those materials that we're talking about, especially Midrash and Talmud, is in what we know of today as Iraq, the Persian Empire. They were tolerated and allowed to thrive and do quite well in Persia. So a lot of the intellectual stream comes out of there, all right, until the 9th century or so. Unfortunately, there aren't a lot of records, but we do know of thriving Jewish communities there. All right. Just to take a look at mysticism in that rabbinic period starts talking about this whole idea of mending or repairing the world, but they do it in a more, of course, mystical sense, cosmic sense. And so it doesn't have really concrete application, but the mystics, particularly a man named Isaac Luria, is the first one where to use the phrase tikkun olam on a regular basis. And for him, what this has to do with is kind of interesting, it's pretty abstract. The way Isaac Luria described it is that the beginning, in creation, when God created light, God made an awful lot of light. And in fact, it was so much light that it shattered the vessels in which the earth was contained and spread further, and beyond those vessels. So what you have are all these little shards of light throughout the universe. All right? Like I said, very abstract, very mystical. What they and what Isaac Luria said the job of a Jew was is to find these shards of light and release that light so it could go back to its origin, because they were trapped in these little shards of glass. And he saw these shards as the Jewish soul. All right? So that, like I said, very abstract, very mystical, and that's like a whole conversation in and of itself. But it's very much a cosmic sense of a perfect universe. All right? And so that was one way of thinking about it. Another key thinker in philosophy during that time was a man named Moses Maimonides, and he's the one I talked about a little bit earlier. He was, as I said, a brilliant individual, and he systematized all that stuff, in terms of Jewish law. And he also did some thinking on that whole issue of the Jewish role in the larger world. What is the role of the Jewish community? And he first, about when he started thinking about it, says, maybe it has something to do with morality. Maybe it is the job of the Jewish community to persuade and educate the non-Jewish community, maybe it should be the other way around, educate and persuade, to follow at least the Noahide commandments. That's a set of rules found near the Noah story, and it's kind of like the short version of the Ten Commandments, the really basic stuff, like don't kill, all right? And he said, maybe it's our responsibility as Jews to educate and persuade our non-Jewish neighbors because this is a better moral system. That was part of it, and that there's been that current throughout Jewish history. Maimonides also thought, you know, there is a material side to this as well. He said, you know, I think that the non-Jew, the poor of the non-Jews, should be buried among the poor of the Jews, that they have no other burial place. He said, we can at least do that. And he also said the poor of the non-Jews should be counted among the poor of the Jews. So we can help the poor and we can help people who have no other burial place. You know, some of those very basic needs that could be met. So he talked a little bit about that. And he, because he said, after all, he went back to Psalm 145, he says, you know, human beings are created in the image of God. And what is God about, after all? It says in Psalm 145, God is good to all, and his mercy is on all his creatures. So again, if we are created in the image of God, rationalized by Maimonides, then we too ought to have mercy on all God's creatures. So he looked at it moral as well as material realms. You have kind of an interesting development with those mystical texts, and this bridges us into modern Judaism. You have a group emerging really in the 18th century. I didn't put them under modern Judaism, although the time frame fits. I see them kind of falling between that rabbinic period and modern period. A group of Jews in Eastern and Central Europe and into Russia that we today call Hasidic Jews. They were very much influenced by the mystical stuff that had been going on, but they were also very traditional in their views and observance of Jewish law. So you have a blend of traditional Jews as well as with the more mystical, joy-filled, the way they self-describe, joy-filled approach. It was really, this movement was very attractive to poor Jews. Who had nothing else. And it was really started by leaders, perhaps a name that you might be familiar with, Baal Shem Tov. There are others like him, but who is considered, and by many, to be a Messiah figure. Okay. Another figure in that time period was a man called Shabtai Tzvi, who is considered to be a messianic figure to Jews in that part of the world. Shabtai Tzvi eventually was imprisoned in the Islamic world, and he converted to Islam. So that didn't turn out so well for their messianic expectations, but there was a real hope for a Messiah during this period. The sense was that things can't possibly get any worse. If you take a look at the 1600s and 1500s, in 1566 you have what they call the Shmielniki massacre, which is not written about very often, but thousands upon thousands of Jews were killed in what we know of today as Poland. All right, and pogroms were a fairly regular sort of activity, and Jews were really, really becoming desperate. And so you see this mystical, messianic approach to Judaism being very attractive, and that's what is wrapped up in this Hasidic Judaism. If you were to see an ultra-Orthodox Jew and a Hasidic Jew on the street of New York, you wouldn't probably be able to tell the difference by looking at them, because their clothing and approach to Judaism is very similar. You might be able to tell, however, in worship, right? And by different approaches, different bodies of literature that they bring into play. But they look very similar. All right? Now that movement spread like wildfire, this Hasidic Judaism, throughout Central Eastern and Eastern Europe and Russia. What was emerging at the same time, however, over in places like Germany and France, was a different sort of thing going on. The Enlightenment was emerging with people like Spinoza and other sorts of thinkers. You have a scientific approach, a reevaluation of methodology and how we look at nature and our role in the universe, all that sort of thing was happening. And you also have something that emerged in this period called emancipation, where Jews were, by law, released from their ghettos or shtetls. By being released, they were allowed to vote They were allowed to matriculate in universities. They were able to join guilds. They were able to own land. They were able to move in next to their fellow Germans. And for the first time, call themselves Germans, even if their families had lived there for 800 years. But they were allowed to have citizenship. And so you had this really, the first time where you see Jews integrating into wider society. And that's where you see this whole idea of tikkun olam and a reevaluation again of the Jewish role in the wider world, because they were part of the wider world for the first time in a very, very long time. Right. So you've got a couple of things that emerged during this period. With this entry into the modern world and into society at large, some Jews started asking themselves, how are we to be Jews in this modern world? How are we to be Jews when we can now integrate and mix? What is at the core? What does it really mean to be Jewish? And some of them, I think, what I described, took a very Lutheran approach. They looked at all this Talmud, all their legal material, and they said, you know, it's not the letter of the law so much as it is the spirit of the law. All right, so we don't need to necessarily abide by the laws of kosher, the dietary laws, traditional dress, traditional forms of worship, and all the other commandments that have been a part of who we were. That's not so much who we are. What we are about as Jews is we are a community that believes in one God, and we have some ethical foundations that are key to who we are more than legal sorts of things. In this time period then, and not all Jews certainly were agreed upon this. This was pretty radical, but many were. And so they saw themselves, and you see some of the first secular Jews emerging. Jews by culture and by ethics and by approach, not so much by religion. Okay? And in this, what does it mean to be a Jew? This whole idea of ethical monotheism and serving the community, they again took that whole idea of being a blessing seriously. And they looked at their situation in Europe and thought, okay, we need to get involved with the underdogs. So you see a lot of labor movement starting in Europe and then coming to the United States. You see a lot of anything that had to do with national welfare and promoting the well-being of all citizens, Jews were generally alive with those causes, right? Especially in Europe. And that translated.
So social justice became one of the definitions?
One of the definitions of who they were as Jews. It didn't necessarily need to be kosher, but social justice came to be core to the identity of many Jews during that time. Not all, but a lot of Jewish thinkers at that time, right? So you have that kind of happening as well in that time period. And so you could have Jews, and what some scholars suggest is that what Jews started doing in this period of emancipation, both in Europe and as millions of them came to the United States, that they started, that they really applied the same principles that they used in their own communities, isolated communities before, and extended those to the broader community. So their concern for the poor, the orphan, the widow, for education, for clothing and shelter that had been more focused internally was now extended to a wider audience, all right, because they were allowed to do so. So you have Jews helping to found hospitals and orphanages and working in the medical profession and all kinds of different things at this period. It looked like a real period of hope, at least in some parts of Europe, Western Europe in particular for Jews. Eastern Europe didn't look so good in Russia. So you kind of have a split there. But then you start seeing tensions again at the end of the 19th century. And you start seeing that even though there's this enlightenment and emancipation, there were still really deep roots that were anti-Jewish. Right? And anytime there's an economic downturn or a societal upheaval, you had Jews or you had people looking around and saying, it's got to be those Jews. It's got to be those Jews. They're, you know, and a lot of stereotypes were so deeply part of the European soil Going back to earlier than the medieval period, where those anti-Semitic and anti-Jewish attitudes thrived during the medieval period, and they thrived under people like Martin Luther, whose writings toward the Jews are terrible. Not all of them have even been translated, but they are hateful, hateful writings. And that contributed to the atmosphere of anti-Jewishness that was sort of beneath the surface. You know, you see this hope of emancipation and enlightenment, but those anti-Jewish roots were never really wiped out. So towards the end of the 19th century, there's a very famous event that, at least in the Jewish community, that brought a lot of this to the head and helped focus some Jewish leaders. Has anybody heard of the Dreyfus Affair? What you had is a French Jewish official a military officer who was tried and convicted for crimes he did not commit simply because he was Jewish. A man who happened to be covering that trial, a Jewish reporter named Theodor Herzl from Vienna, a secular Jew, so not religiously observant. This trial brought some things into real focus for him. He thought, if a man like Dreyfus can be tried and convicted in the highest courts of France, a very modern sort of place, what's the hope for the rest of us? And he started thinking at that time, you know, we might really need to have a place where Jews can go to be safe. And pogroms were really, really increasing in Eastern Europe at this time, massacres and assaults. And so in 1896 in Basel, Switzerland, Theodor Herzl pulled together the first World Zionist Congress. First Jewish Congress, and started thinking about that idea of a Jewish homeland. All right, so you have that sort of thing emerging. Now, Herzl was hoping for some sort of safe place. A lot of options emerged on the table for where that safe land might be. Different locations in Africa, South America, Argentina was considered. So they looked at a whole bunch of different places, as well as Palestine. Herzl, I don't think, imagined at that point how bad it would actually be in another 35, 40 years. I don't think in his wildest dreams he could imagine that the Holocaust would have ever happened. He saw the need for a safe haven. I don't think he imagined a widespread massacre. And that's in fact what did happen when we take a look at the 1939 through 45, but even years prior to that, where anti-Semitism in Europe was growing and increasing at an alarming rate. So that by the Holocaust, under somebody like Adolf Hitler, you had a third of the Jewish world population being completely wiped out. Out of 18 million Jews in the world that they counted, that we can, or best guess, 6 million at least were wiped out. All of a sudden then, you emerging on the other side of the Holocaust, you have some really significant questions coming up. How are we to still be Jews after God abandoned us or was absent during that event? Does God really care? So these were serious soul-searching questions, and they needed to be asked. They needed to be asked, and sometimes it's hard for other faith communities and Christians to hear those sorts of questions because they seem, you know, perhaps disloyal, or they seem too doubting. But in fact, when you had that sort of catastrophic event occur, you had Jewish thinkers and regular people just asking those sorts of questions. And some Jews, not all, some Jews emerged on the other side of the Holocaust saying, yeah, we can be Jews. We can. However, it's not going to be the same anymore. The covenant that God made with us before has been broken, and we need to join this covenant and reaffirm it, but we're going to choose to do so on our own terms. Right? And that, going back to the be a blessing, that command, they said perhaps God wants us to have a far more active role in that be a blessing than we'd previously thought. That be a blessing means that we perhaps are partners with God in this whole enterprise, and that it is, in fact, our job, not God's job, to repair, mend, or perfect the world. Some people say, oh, that's pretty presumptuous. On the flip side, when you come through something like the Holocaust, if it doesn't fundamentally change your views or challenge your views, then something else is not right. All right, so that's one approach to that. How does a key thinker like Emil Fackenheim, who thought a lot about this, he's one of the key 20th century Jewish philosophers, I'm thinking of this whole issue of tikkun and the Jewish role in the world. And for him, he saw the basis of tikkun olam in the survivors of the Holocaust, the very fact that they lived through it. He saw a hope in them. And he started thinking a little bit about this new state of Israel that emerged shortly after World War II, 1948. And he saw hope for tikkun olam and hope for the world in the very existence of Israel. Thought if an Israel can emerge from this, perhaps there is a God, and perhaps Israel is how we can see tikkun olam at work. Now that's become more problematic in recent years, as we know that things between the Israelis and the Palestinians have not necessarily suggested a tikkun olam, but Emil Fackenheim and a lot of Jews had real hope at the outset for Israel. So at that point, Emil Fackenheim was working primarily in the United States. You had a real blossoming in the American Jewish community after World War II in terms of really getting involved in social action. I'm a product of some of that social action. I attended for my PhD Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati, which was the first reform seminary in the world. They train reform rabbis, and after World War II, they established a program called the Christian Fellows Program, because it was only men then, to join them in their studies. So that they thought understanding and education is one way to make sure this will never happen again. So they invited Christian scholars to come, and that program quickly turned into a PhD program that where Jewish and Christian scholars could join together and study in the context of a rabbinical seminary and learn with each other and from each other. That was one area of social action. All kinds of different things. If you take back even a look at the early 1900s and then the 1920s in the United States, New York, have you heard of Emma Goldman? Real key labor organizer. Jews were at the forefront of labor and union movements in the United States. Very key in setting up unions and labor movements among the poorest of the poor, whether they were Jews or any other immigrant or citizen or resident of the United States. They thought, okay, they saw that as a real place to get involved. So you have this sort of tradition of Jewish political, social, all kinds of action in the everyday realm, being really a part of who Jews are, and really at the core of especially Reform Jewish and conservative Jewish identity. They see that as central to who they are today. And if you take a look online, tikkun olam and perhaps the mission statement on the computer on Yahoo, you'll come up with at least 20 different mission statements from synagogues around the United States that have tikkun olam as a central or key feature to their mission statement. So it's kind of one of those things. The phrase tikkun olam emerged actually in the late 50s, early 60s, out of a Jewish social action movement in California, and like summer camp sort of ministry sort of things and social action, and really became in the 70s, late 60s and 70s, the phrase that embodied Jewish identity and role in the larger world. It's a phrase then that has ancient origins, but very modern usage, because it didn't mean the same thing in the ancient world as it does today, but it embodies a lot of principles that have been part of Judaism and a part of Hebrew and Israelite culture from the very beginning. But it kind of brings in those. And what we're going to take a look at for the rest of the week are ways that that's kind of worked itself out. Tikkun olam has come to embody environmental concerns in a big way. It's also come to embody women's movement and equal rights and equality between genders and trying to figure out what the role of women in a healed, perfect, mended world might look like and the relationships between men and women in such a world. So you have a lot of feminists and Jewish thinkers writing about that. And we're going to look at those on Friday and then Saturday morning. Tomorrow, however, we're going to take a look at this whole idea of tikkun olam and take a look at some of Luther's writings on vocation and see where a lot of Protestant and specifically Lutheran thinking intersect with this tikkun olam sort of thinking, to see if there are paths where they cross, to see where there might be some perhaps differences in what the two traditions can learn from each other. So we're not going to go through all of Luther's works. He wrote a lot about vocation, but some key texts that we'll examine. And we've just got a few minutes, and I've been talking a lot, partly because there's a lot of background to give. Normally, I don't run classes like this, but when I do history, I have a lot to. So I apologize for that, but I'd be happy to. I really enjoy, appreciate your comments too. If you have things that this has made you think about or questions.
I was just going to make a general observation. It's a wonderful survey. You've covered so much in a short time. But well, I mean, it's just great. It's nicely organized. Wonderful review. A lot of new things too.
To kind of put that sort of thing in a perspective. Yeah, this is right. A semester course, by the way. And each of those, I've offered courses on tiny bits of these sorts of things, but yeah, to try to get a big picture so that when you do your own reading and when you do your own, you have some sort of framework on which to hang some of those ideas.
Nice about it. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what I've tried to do. In some ways, it makes for a lot of, whoosh. But on the flip side, sometimes it can be helpful. What my hope is that this will encourage you to read and think about these things with a little bit of more perspective, perhaps. What were you going to say?
Well, I was wondering, did I hear you that you got some training to be a women rabbi?
No, I was actually at a seminary, though, and I went to classes with rabbis. And I was actually a TA for rabbis.
Okay.
So I actually had the privilege to teach rabbis their 1 year, their first course in Mishnah. Now, it wasn't that a hoot. So I had, 16 rabbinical students, men and women, in class. And they looked at me and... we started talking, and some of them knew me from outside, and one of them said, "So, isn't this kind of weird? I come to Hebrew Union to learn, rabbinic literature and Mishnah, and my first teacher is a goy. That's it. Somebody's a non-Jew." But, it worked out okay, and I think it was important for both of us, the students as well as for me, to see what we can learn from each other. And I think it was important for them to see that I had a lot of investment in their sacred texts, and that my life is enmeshed in those texts as theirs perhaps might be. So yeah, I wasn't a rabbinical student, but I did a lot of the same courses, and I helped to teach some of those courses to rabbinical students. So it was really exciting sort of place. So I learned my Talmud. I was the only Christian student in a group of Talmudic students as we worked our way through Talmud and similar sorts of things. So yeah, I had some really unique opportunities. And learning some of these texts.
Where are you teaching now?
I teach at Luther College. Sorry, I didn't mention that. I teach at Luther College in Decorah, Iowa, and I teach in the Religion and Philosophy department. My main areas are Bible and Judaism. So every semester I offer courses in Bible as a survey course of Old and New Testaments, and every alternating semester I teach Hebrew Bible, Introduction to Hebrew Bible. Which is really more my area, and then I always am teaching a course that has something to do with Judaism, at least one or two a year. So this past year I taught a course in general introduction to Judaism, where we did this sort of thing over the course of a semester, and I also taught a course in the spring to senior religion majors on introduction to rabbinic literature, where we specifically look more at Talmud and Midrash. And we're able to work through some of those texts and learn methodology, because it's not so easy to do. But it's also a lot of fun.
You mentioned that this gives us a frame of reference in which to read. I think it would be interesting for us to hear if there are any texts that survey this that you like.
Yeah, I should put together some of those, and there are definitely some texts that talk about these sorts of things. There's a book that I can think of that surveys how the Bible and these texts work. It's more a textual piece, but it deals with the text in all these periods. It's called Back to the Sources, and it's by a guy named Barry Holtz, H-O-L-T-Z. You can order it on Amazon, and you can even do it used, and I bet you can get it for $3. So it's paperback, and it's one of the standards in the field. Very helpful text. An Introduction to Judaism, which is sort of a textbook, but not written so densely, is An Intro to Judaism, and the last name is Trepp, T-R-E-P-P, Leo Trepp. And he's done some intros, and again, I would go to Amazon for that. There are a lot of different introductions to Judaism, though, that you can find. Another good writer thinker in the area is a man named Irving Greenberg, and he looks a lot at post-Holocaust theology and role of Jews in this world. He's a modern Orthodox Jew. Jewish feminist writer who has written an influential text in the early 90s, but it's now almost a classic, Standing Again at Sinai by a woman named Judith Plaskow, P-L-A-S-K-O-W. And those are just a few to kind of get people going in this sort of thing. So, and there are many more, and I can, you can take my email and if you're looking for recommendations. But those are some just basics that I've used for classes and that give good overviews of a lot of this stuff.
None of them give me that history though.
Leo Trepp would.
Leo?
Yeah, Leo Trepp would do that. It's like an introduction to Judaism. Yeah. And he would do that.
Sternberg, that little paperback.
Yeah, that's good stuff too.
Those are all more
general,
and don't do this life's history.
No, I think Trepp does that, mm-hmm. And there are some more popular texts that are out there, and there's I think his last name is Kirsch, and K-I-R-S-C-H. Yeah. He has a Harlot by the Side of the Road, which deals with biblical women and women in Jewish history.
Read that.
He's more from a journalist perspective, right. But he's got another one on Judaism. And kind of he puts this whole perspective in Jewish history together from Bible to current times in almost a novel format. And so, it's a good popular read. It doesn't read at all like a textbook, but it's one of those things that's great to just read through. And I'll try to get the title of that one, but I've used that in class too, because it's not so textbookish in that approach. And he's not a Jewish scholar, but I like his job actually. He's a lawyer in LA and who happens to be Jewish and interested in things Jewish, and he publishes on a really regular basis and practices a little law on the side. So I suppose we should go to Vespers, but thank you very much, and if you have questions that come up, let me know. So thank you.